And we are on. It's unbelievable how every year there are new commentaries on the Haggadah coming out. And every year I give a shiur on Kol Chav HaShachar and in different places on Chidushim of the Haggadah. And there's always something new. And today I printed out this list of Chidushim. By the way, I strongly suggest, if you wanted to use this at the Seder, I strongly suggest either you take notes as we go, or quickly print it out and then write the notes on the source sheet, because b'mfurash, in order to keep it short to two pages, what I did is I stressed the key word on everything, and hopefully that'll remind you what the chidush was. But again, if I did not write the chidushim on the page itself. Okay, I'm going to start out with a quick story that I've told in the past of very basic about the Haggadah. If you look in Source 5, we all know that we begin Magid with Halach Ma'anya Da'achalu Avotena Ba'ara Demitzrayim, that this is the bread of poverty, some translated as affliction, that our forefathers ate in Egypt. Kol dichvin yaiti v'echol. Whoever is hungry, he should come in and do the Seder Pesach with us. And I'll just mention two commentaries. Number one, I think this is from the Perush HaKadmon, that everyone is hungry on Erev Pesach because there are a lot of things that you can't eat. You can't eat chametz after the fourth hour, and you can't eat matzah all day. And you can't eat boiled matzah or fried matzah after the 10th hour. And Bechorim, they bichlal can't eat anything unless they were at a siyum. So usually most people coming into the Seder are hungry. And this is a general invitation for all those who are hungry, which is everyone, come in and let's start the Seder. But I wanted to point out that the famous Italian Jewish author Primo Levi, who was a survivor of one of the death camps, he writes that on the day of the liberation of the camps, when the Allies came in, all of the inmates ran to the kitchen and ran to the Germans' barracks in order to hoard food. And he knew how to work with his hands. And there was a heater, and it was still cold at night. And there was a heater, and he was working on fixing the heater. And as he was fixing the heater, he realized that when they were inmates in the concentration camp, they really could very rarely do chesed. And here he was. He's a free man. The first thing that he does is he lets everyone else run toward the food. And he knows that there will be food afterwards, and he can voluntarily fix the electric heater. And he goes on to say that one of his friends saw that he stayed back to work on the heater so that it would be warm for everyone in the evening. And his friend gave Primo part of the food that he had hoarded. In other words, both of them now felt that they could do chesed. That's part of being a free person. And as we begin the Seder of Zman Chirutenu, that we are now free people, the first thing that we do is we invite all of the hungry people, all of the poor people, because that is a sign that we are free people, that we, Baruch Hashem, have enough, and we could even share with others. So that's a nice idea. Going back to number one, Kadesh, the first thing in the Seder, there is a custom to pour for everyone their cup. And this is a sign of freedom, that I pour your cup of wine for you, you pour my cup of wine for me, just like a waiter, that's like fancy. But a lot of people don't realize that this is explicit in the Mishnah, in Perek Arvei Pesachim, where it says, Mazgulo Kos Rishon, they poured for him the first cup. And then it says they poured for him the second cup. Why does it say they poured for him? You don't even have to say who's pouring. But this custom of pouring for each other goes back 1,800 years. I'll mention parenthetically that very often at the Seder, we have family members who might not be so religious, and it's a problem for them pouring wine, which is not Yayin Mevushel. So today, a lot of the wine has written on it Yayin Mevushel, and that's no problem for a non-religious person to pour. I'll also mention that Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach points out that a lot of poskim say that all wine today is pasteurized. And there are those that say that all pasteurized wine has the halacha of Yayin Mevushal. So even a non-religious Jew can pour it. But even if it wasn't pasteurized, and even if a person wants to be machmir and be more strict and not rely on those poskim, Rav Avadya Yosef says that if anybody is coming to attend the Seder, he probably believes in God, and somebody like that, so as not to embarrass him, he can pour wine for you. But just to play it safe, we go back to the original custom, which was what? Have the balabait, have the host, go around and pour wine for all of the guests. And that way you also solve the problem of people who are not religious. So you solve two things with two birds with one stone. Number two, who washes for urchatz? I'm talking about the urchatz before karpas. Before matzah, everybody washes their hands. But before karpas, you will find that in some haggadot, it says that the leader of the Seder washes his hands, but in other Haggadot, it doesn't say anything, and everybody washes their hands. So, who is correct? So, the answer is that the Achronim really bring down that we eat less than a kezayit of karpas. When you're eating celery, then you should eat just a small amount. Why? Because the main idea of eating karpas, a lot of people don't know this, is to say the borei pri adama and have in mind that you're being motzi, the maror that you're going to eat later. Because there is a big machloket whether you say borei pri adama on maror. If you're eating a salad or lettuce during the year, then if you washed and you made a motzi, so you don't say borei pri adama on the salad, because that's just part of the meal. But religious eating, something like eating maror, you're not eating it because it's part of the meal. You're eating it because there is a religious obligation to eat the maror. So regarding that, some poskim say you need to say borei pri adama. Others say that you don't need to say borei pri adama. And that's the original reason why we say borei pri adama on karpas. Why do we have this karpas at all? So some say that it is a sign of wealth. Some say it opens up your appetite. Some say it is to get the children to ask. But the halachic reason is in order to say borei pri adama before the matzah and have in mind that that borei pri adama is going to go on the maror as well. Okay? So now we get back to the question. If you're eating less than a kezayit of karpas, then even those who all year round do netilat yadayim when they eat wet fruit and vegetables, there are those who are machmir. Most people are lenient, and that's the minhag of Yerushalayim. But you may know that all year round, many people, myself included, when we eat a wet apple, I'll dry it or I'll wash my hands if it's wet. Grapes, they're always wet, and you can't dry each individual grape. So before you eat it, grapes, a lot of people have the minhag, have the custom of doing netilat yadayim because it is wet, and it can receive tumah. But if you're eating less than a kezayit, then, according to just about all opinions, you don't have to do netilat yadayim. So if karpas is less than a kezayit, who has to do netilat yadayim? The answer is nobody. So why do we do it? Well, Rav Kook explains that at the Seder, we want to act like we did in the Beit HaMikdash, where we were careful regarding taharot, regarding tuman tahara, the pure and the impure. And therefore, even if we're eating less than a kezayit of karpas, Rav Kook, that's how he explains why we do netilat yadayim on karpas. For the same reason, many people have the minhag of wearing a kittel. Where does that come from? Well, that white robe reminds us of the white robes that the Kohanim used to wear in the temple, in the Beit HaMikdash. So just like we dress as if we're in the Beit HaMikdash to remember the Korban Pesach and what Pesach really used to be about, so too we do Netilat Yadayim, but being that it's not really halachic, so usually just the head of the family, just he does Netilat Yadayim. So that's the history behind who does Netilat Yadayim for Karpas. You can do it if it's a balagan, and it's easier just to bring water for one person to do. So you fulfill the idea of doing Karpas, of what doing Netilat Yadayim for Karpas, like it was done in the Beit HaMikdash, and also so the children should ask. Okay. Let's look at in source 6, where we know that one of the reasons why we have drink four cups of wine is for the four lishonot of geula, the four wordings of redemption. What are the four wordings? So it is, we remember this, most of you from elementary school, vahotzeti, and I took you out, vihitzalti, and I saved you, vigaalti, and I redeemed you, and vilakachti, and I will take you. And the Netziv of Velazhen, he asked the obvious question, vehotzeti, that infers that Hashem took us out of Egypt, that should be after vihitzalti, because first God saved us, and then he took us out of Egypt. So why is vehotzeti, and I took you out, before? But if you look at the psukim, the Netziv stresses, it doesn't say vehotzeti etchem mimitzrayim, and I took you out of Egypt. That is not the first pasuk of Geula. Vehotzeti etchem, explains the Netziv, is after the makkah, after the plague of Arov, of the wild animals, Paro lessened our burden. And that's why it says, Vehotzeti misivlot. Hashem took us out of that heavy bondage. And that's why that's the first stage. We aren't out of Egypt yet, and we haven't been saved yet, but Hashem is already beginning taking us out of the bondage. Afterwards is vihitzalti, and I saved you. What is vihitzalti? That is at the Makkah of Barad. During the plague, after the plague of hail, where afterwards Paro stopped the Shiabud, he stopped our working altogether. So then, it's logical to say Vehitzalti, that God saved us from the work. We were no longer slaves. The third stage of Vigaalti is at Makat Bechorot. When God killed the firstborn, that includes Paro's firstborn, and Paro himself, who was a firstborn, he was scared he was going to be killed. That was the straw that broke the camel's back, where Paro said, okay, you can leave. So that's the third stage, and that's what's called Vigaalti. The redemption is when Paro said we could leave Egypt. What is the fourth wording, vilakachti? It's not that I took you out of Egypt. It's vilakachti etchem li la'am. I've taken you for my nation, v'itim lechem l'Elohim, and I will be your God. Where is that? That's only at Mount Sinai. When we received the Torah, that's when we really accepted God. We accepted his Torah, and that is what is vilakachti li la'am. I took you, again, not out of Egypt, but I took you for me, for a nation. Where is that? That is the spiritual redemption. So, again, if the question was, why is Vahutseti, and I took you, why is that already the first word of redemption? Well, because it's not talking about taking us out of Egypt. And here we also have something interesting. The Ramban mentions that Sefer Shemot is called Sefer HaGeula. It's the book of redemption. Now that is logical for the first four parshiot. But after Bishalach, we are free. So why is it called the book of redemption? The redemption is until the end of Parshat Bishalach. What happens afterwards in Yitro and in the subsequent parshiot? Hashem gives us the Torah, and we build the Mishkan. And the Ramban stresses that is also considered part of Sefer HaGeula, because it's not just enough to be free from slavery, it's not just enough to be out of Egypt, but to be a real free man, you have to be totally free. How is one free? Through the Torah. And this is something that we've spoken about in the past, that Rav Kook in his commentary on the Haggadah, the main theme is freedom. And Rav Kook says, what is the ultimate in freedom? That a person is so free that he has control even over his freedom. And that is the difference between anarchy and freedom. Before we received the Torah, we could live a life of anarchy. But once we receive the 613 mitzvot, then we acquire also the discipline to be really free. So free that we don't just run after this desire or that desire, but we're totally free to be ourselves. Like if you ask somebody who did something really stupid, and he worked his whole life to achieve a good, a shining career, and then he made a stupid mistake. Does that mean that the real me is that stupid mistake? No, the real me is how I worked hard over 40, 50 years. But that stupid mistake is when I listened to my Yetzer Hara and I didn't listen to the real me. And that's where Rav Kook explains why we eat maror. Maror is the bitterness that we needed to undergo that stage of being slaves in Egypt, where when you're a slave, you learn discipline. You have no free will. But afterwards, when we are no longer slaves, we still have that capability of disciplining ourselves, of choosing to do the mitzvot. And this is what the famous Dr. Eric Fromm, who was big in the 1960s when all the kids were talking about freedom, freedom, all the parents were raising their children on freedom. And then Eric Fromm said, well, the hippies are raising their children not on freedom, but on anarchy. And he wrote a book called Escape from Freedom. And that is why we eat the korech, explains Rav Kook, where we take the matzah, which symbolizes freedom. We take the maror, which symbolizes the bitter discipline that we had, and we eat them together, showing that the two do not contradict. Okay? Let us go on. Source 7. It's interesting. Is Avi Shechtman joined us yet?
I didn't see him on the list yet.
Okay. V'seder gamor. So we'll continue. In Source 7, we see something very interesting. It says, "Afilu kulanu chachamim, kulanu nivonim." Even if all of us are smart, "V'kulanu zkenim," we're all wise. "Kulanu yodim et haTorah," we all know the Torah. We all know the story of Yitziat Mitzrayim. And nevertheless, "Mitzvah aleinu lesaper b'Yitziat Mitzrayim," we still tell every Pesach the story of our exodus from Egypt. And the more we tell about it, hare, that's great. Okay. And then we read the story, Maaseh Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yoshua, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Tarfon, these great rabbis, that they were sitting around in Bnei Brak, and they were telling the story of Yitziat Mitzrayim all night. And until a student came and said, my rabbis, the time has come to say Kriyat Shema of the morning. And the question is, and again, I strongly suggest you write these down, because it's hard to remember all these questions and chidushim. But the question is, why does the student say, well, the time has come to say Kriyat Shema? We have a rule in halacha that ha'osek ba'mitzvah patur mina mitzvah. So if they are telling the story of Yitziat Mitzrayim, they are exempt from saying Kriyat Shema at that time. So why mention Kriyat Shema? Question number one. Question number two, and this is interesting, Rebbe Eliezer and also Rebbe Eliezer ben Azariah are of the opinion that you only eat Korban Pesach until Chatzot, until midnight. And the whole mitzvah of telling Haggadah is at the time of eating Korban Pesach. Be'et, at the time that Matzan Maror Munachim Lefanecha, and the Korban Pesach is before you. If so, notice, they were not doing the mitzvah of telling Yitziat Mitzrayim Midoraita. Because according to their opinion, if they're telling the story Yitziat Mitzrayim all night, they say that it's just a mitzvah until midnight. Now I understand why it says, it doesn't say the more you tell about Yitziat Mitzrayim, the greater the mitzvah is. Because for half of their opinions, it wasn't even a mitzvah. But nevertheless, they're coming to teach us that even if it's not a mitzvah after midnight, according to many opinions, they still continue to tell the story, because the more you tell the story of Yitziat Mitzrayim, the better. And now you also understand the first question. Why does this nudnik, the student, come and tell them, it's time to say Kriyat Shema? Are they're doing a mitzvah? Well, the answer is, according to half of them, it's not really a mitzvah. It is mishubach. It is good, to even after midnight, to continue telling the story of Yitziat Mitzrayim. But they were not exempt from Kriyat Shema. And not only that, in Kriyat Shema, in the third chapter of Kriyat Shema, we say, Ani Hashem Elokechem asher hotzeiti etchem me'aretz Mitzrayim. In the Parsha of Tzitzit, which we say during Kriyat Shema, they are fulfilling, we mention that Hashem took us out of Egypt, and that is a mitzvah de'oraita, a mitzvah of Kriyat Shema. If so, we now understand why they tell them, Higiyaz van Kriyat Shema, it's time to say Kriyat Shema, where we could tell the story of the Exodus from Egypt on a level of de'oraita, and not just on a level where it's good, it's nice, hareza mishubach. Now here also I will add something very important about how to run the Seder. It says in Masechet Pesachim, on Daf Kuf Tet Zayin, it says that on the night of the Seder, we grab the matzot in order to keep the children from falling asleep. Now the Rambam explains that's the source of the game of stealing, grabbing the afikoman, grabbing it, hiding it, but the Ra'avad explains that Gemara totally differently. Listen well. The Ra'avad says, what does it mean when the Gemara says we grab the matzot so that the children don't fall asleep at the Seder? He says, grab the matzot means hurry through Magid. Don't drag out the Haggadah so long that the 7 and 8 year olds are getting bored, and they're hungry. Grab the matzot, go through Magid, obviously tell the story, explain it, say some Divrei Torah, but then this is what the Netziv says, grab the matzot, get to Motzi, Matzah, Maror, Korech, Shulchan Orech, when the kids, the 7 year olds, the 9 year olds, the teenagers are saying, hey, I'm hungry, let's not drag out the Pesach. And then they're going to have negative association with the Seder because they don't enjoy the Seder. So the Netziv says, when does it, when should we elaborate and say all the Divrei Torah and stay up with our 18-year-old yeshiva boys and midrasha girls and go through all the Divrei Torah that they prepared? When is that? The Netziv says, after the children have gone to sleep. you could say Chag Gadiah at 10 o'clock, at 11 o'clock, and that's when you can really elaborate, after the children have gone to sleep. And that fits in very well with the Ra'avad's explanation. What does it mean? Grab the matzot so the children don't fall asleep. Grab the matzot, hurry through Magid, so that you don't lose the children by making the Seder too long. Another explanation, let us look together in 8, where we know of the four sons, the first son is the Chacham, the wise son. Mahu Omer, what does he say? He asks, and this is, you all know that the Torah says four times, if your son shall ask you, or you shall tell your son. Those are, and each time it's worded a little differently, according to educate each type of sons, because in most families, there are different type of children. So the Chacham, he, Chazal say, that is the son who asks, Maheidut v'chukim v'mishpatim, what are all these mitzvot, asher tziva Hashem Elokeinu etchem, that God commanded you to do on the night of Pesach? Baruch ata Adonai Eloheinu melech ha'olam shehakol nehiya bidvaro. But the Haggadah does not give the answer which is mentioned in the Torah. The Haggadah says, how do you answer the wise son? Af ata emor lo kil chota Pesach. Explain to him the laws of Pesach. Ein maftirin achar ha-Pesach afikoman. That you don't eat after the Korban Pesach, you're not allowed to eat dessert. Why is this the answer to the wise son, especially if that's not the answer that the Torah gives him? So we're going to suggest two answers that I saw. First of all, the Vilna Gaon and many Haggadot say that what is the answer to the wise son? The answer is, teach him the laws of Pesach until you get to that halacha in Maftirin Achara Pesach Afikoman, that you don't eat dessert after the Afikoman. The Afikoman is the last taste that should stay as the taste in your mouth till you go to sleep. So what is the Vilna Gaon? How is he explaining it? He's explaining, go through all of the laws of the Seder with the Chacham, because what did he ask? Ma ha'edut, what are the laws and the mitzvot? So the Vilna Gaon explains, tell him all the mitzvot, the whole Seder, go through Kadesh, Urchatz, Karpas, Yachatz, all the way until you get to the Afikoman, right? That was the original end of the Seder, and that is the end of Mishnayot Arvei Pesachim. The last chapter of Masechet Pesachim, where it talks about the Haggadah, the last Mishnah, our division of the Mishnayot is a little different, but the last Mishnah is, what do you do after the Haggadah? After the Afikoman, I'm sorry, you don't eat. So, that's the first explanation. What do you explain to the Chacham? Well, he asks, what are the mitzvot? And you go through all the mitzvot until the very last mitzvah, which is that you don't eat after the Afikoman. But I mentioned at the Shiur tonight, and Davka Rav Oad said, out of all the things that I said, this is what he liked the best. What is another explanation? All right, the wise son, he noticed that at the beginning of the Seder, what does it say? It says that the father should give out klayot ve'egozim, give out chocolates and candies and nuts, so that the children will stay awake. Now, usually, when do we eat the chocolate and the nuts and the goodies? We usually eat that for dessert. But the word afikoman in Greek means dessert. And after we eat the Korban Pesach, we don't eat dessert. Today, we, instead of Korban Pesach, we eat the Afikoman. But after the Afikoman, we don't eat dessert. So the wise son, he asks, when he sees the father giving out the chocolate and the goodies at the beginning of the meal, he says, hey, what's going on? And that's why the Haggadah answers him, well, we give out the goodies now, because tonight is different, and tonight there is no dessert. So we're going to eat dessert beforehand. Why? Because on this day, 3,335 years ago, Hashem took us out of Egypt.
Excuse me, Adi Shachman joined. He wanted me to let you know.
Great. Todah rabah. Thank you. Okay, so let us go to, we're going to do things that we didn't do tonight in the Shiur. Let us go to Source 16. Source 16. V'yotzi'inu Hashem mimitzrayim. Hashem took us out of Egypt. Lo al yedei malach. Hashem himself took us out. He didn't take us out by an angel. Lo al yedei saraf. Not through another messenger. Lo al yedei shaliach. Ela kadosh baruch hu bichvodo uve'atzmo. As it says, Ve'avarti beretz mitzrayim balayla hazeh. Hashem said, I went over Egypt on this night. V'iketi kol b'chor beretz mitzrayim mi'adamad be'ema. And I killed the firstborns of the animals, of the people. Uvechol Elohim Mitzrayim Esesh Fatim Ani Hashem. And I punished all of the gods of Egypt. Now, a lot of commentaries ask, where do we see that God punished the gods of Egypt? It doesn't say that anywhere. So there are those that say, well, let's take it from the top. There's a professor, Yehuda, who is an Egyptologist, and he writes that as a historian, you go through the 10 plagues, and each one of the 10 plagues is a punishment showing the Jews that he ain't God, and he ain't God, and he's not God, and for example, all pagan religions serve their big river as the source of their sustenance. And similarly, that's why the Egyptians served the Nile. The first Makkah, the first plague, when God turned the Nile into blood, well, that showed that the Nile is not God. Let's go on. The Egyptians had a god of fertility, just like most of the pagans. But the goddess of fertility in Egypt was a frog. And the Makav Bechorot, God turned the frogs into the laughing stock of Egypt. So I guess the frogs also are not God. And then he goes on, and God, I still remember in fifth grade, when we learned a little about ancient Egypt, that one of their strongest gods was Ra, the god of the sun, right? All pagans have the god of the sun. Well, obviously, Makat Choshech, the plague of turning the sun off, and showed that the sun is not the god. And also, the old pagans, they used to think that their king was God. And the king, Pharaoh, in Sefer Yechezkel, he says, I'm God, Li Yori, I created the Nile, Vani Asitini. So if Pharaoh is God, and God is killing all of the firstborns, and he kills the son of Pharaoh, who is the next god, quote-unquote, well, we see that the firstborns and the pharaohs are not God either. In other words, where did God fulfill this idea of punishing the gods of Egypt? So Professor Yehuda proves that all of the 10 makot are on the gods of Egypt. 17. This is a very timely Dvar Torah, which Rav Dov Lior, the Rav of Hebron, he brings it in his Haggadah, where, if you remember, there are different drashot learning out from different phrases in Sefer Shemot, in Sefer, in Parshat Kitavo, and on the phrase Ubizroa Netuya, an outstretched arm. Chazal, in the Haggadah, we say, what does it mean, an outstretched arm? Zo hacherev. This is the sword. Shene'emar, as the Pasuk says, V'charbo shlufa biyado. The sword is out. Shlufa means out of its holster. Nituya, there's a word for a holster for a sword. Anybody remember? Where you keep the sword?
Scabbard.
What?
Scabbard.
That's it. Scabbard. Todah rabah. Oh, I'm so glad that you came, Avi Shechtman. Just in time. So it says that the sword is taken out of the scabbard, Nituya al Yerushalayim, and it is still hanging over. Now, this pasuk is not from the Torah, and it's not talking about Yitziat Mitzrayim. But what the Haggadah wants to show is that Zroa HaNetuya is referring to the Cherev, the sword. Now, what does it mean, the sword, and where did God take out a sword against the Egyptians? Rav Dov Lior explains that what's different, what's unique about the sword is that you take it out and you keep fighting until you finish and you can put it back in the scabbard. And that is the term Zroa Netuya. God's arm continued to stay out, and he just kept beating the Egyptians and Paro plague after plague after plague. And Rav Dov Lior, anybody who knows him, said the message for us in our war against Hamas is obvious, that we should not put our sword back in its scabbard until we keep beating and beating and beating them until they get down on their knees and ask for mercy. So that is the symbolism of the sword. So when did God have his Zroa Netuya? And what is the sword of God? The fact that he kept sending plague after plague after plague and did not have mercy until they let the Jews out of Egypt. Again, for those who are going to lead a Seder and mention a very timely Divrei Torah during our war against Hamas and now against Iran, this is the way of the Torah. Okay, in Source 18, there's another aspect of the Haggadah, which I remember as a kid, well, always I didn't understand. Why is it, you remember Rabbi Yossi Aglili says that B'Mitzrayim, God gave 10 plagues, and by the sea, he gave 50 plagues. Well, we know the math, because 10 is called the Etzba, and 5 is called the Yad, so 10 times 5, that's 50. But where does God do 50 plagues at the sea? And not only that, Rabbi Lezer, he goes on to say, no, it wasn't 50. It says that there were 40 makot in Egypt and 200 by the sea. And now this is not written in the Torah. So now what's even more, Rabbi Akiva says, oh, you think it was 50? You think it was 200? No. In Mitzrayim, God gave 50 makot, and on the sea, he gave 250 makot. Okay? So what is this idea of the inflation of the number of makot? So the Vilna Gaon explains very, very beautifully. There's a pasuk that Hashem says, Kol makah asher heveti al Mitzrayim, asher samti al Mitzrayim lo asim alecha. Every plague that I brought upon the Egyptians, I will not bring upon you, Am Yisrael. So the rabbis, the more plagues that they say that Hashem brought on the Egyptians, the less plagues he is going to bring on us. Because every plague that Hashem brought on the Egyptians, he does not bring onto us. So that also is very interesting.
And we're I always thought of that when my children had Canaan.
Oh,
we all got Corona.
Okay. We're running out of time. So I want to mention the Chad Gadya, and then one last explanation that I mention every year simply because I'm very convinced that it is the truth. First of all, by Chad Gadya. If you look at Chad Gadya, this is from Rabbi Yonatan Eifshitz. It says, we just brought the last verse of the Chad Gadya. You know, let's start from the end. We know that our father bought this goat for 2 zuzim, and a cat came and ate the goat, which means that the cat is the bad guy. And then the dog eats the cat to stand up for the goat, so I guess the dog is the good guy. But then the stick beat the dog, so the stick is the bad guy. And then the water is the good guy. And then you just take it, good guy, bad guy, good guy, bad guy. The problem is that way it turns out that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the bad guy. And that can't be. You all with me? Right? Because again, if the Gdi is the good guy, and the cat is the bad guy, so the dog who eats the cat, he's on the good guy's side, and so forth and so forth. But the problem is, that way it turns out that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is a bad guy. So Rabbi Yonatan Eibshitz said that we don't know, and it doesn't say, what the goat did to the cat. And I know as a child, you know, whenever I would fight with my brother, it was always he started. And Rabbi Yonatan Eibshitz had this famous argument with Rav Yaakov Vemdin, and we won't get into the details, but it fits in very well. So you have, usually, there aren't that many Divrei Torah for Chad Gadya. By that time, everyone's tired out. But here, now you have a Dvar Torah for Chad Gadya. We'll finish off with one last Dvar Torah. Again, it's such a beautiful Dvar Torah that even if you heard a shiur from me in the past, I hope this sounds familiar, simply because there are so many different explanations. What does it mean that by the, go back to number 9, what does it mean that the Rasha, af ata hake et shinav? The Rasha, again, let's go over it. He says, ma avodah zot lechem, what is this work for you? And he says, for you, v'lo, and not for me. Because he doesn't include himself as part of the Jewish people, he doesn't observe Pesach, kafar be'ikar, so he doesn't believe in God. So what do we do? Afata hakeh chinav, so to you, what does it mean, so to you? Hakeh chinav, and that's the problem. Hakeh chinav, it doesn't mean, as a kid I thought, hakeh means to hit. Hit him in the face. Right? Remember that one? My grandfather used to threaten me, oh, I'll give you a rap in the mouth. So I thought it was hit the evil son in the teeth. But anybody who knows Hebrew knows hey kuf hey hey is not hey kaf hey. To hit him in the teeth is not hey kuf hey hey. Now, I have seen at least 5-6 totally different explanations what this hakeh chinav, but I am very convinced of the explanation of Rav Bakshi Doron, who's the former chief rabbi. Just finish off the explanation. Ve'amorlo bavur ze, before, let's read the rest. And tell, after we, hakeh, I'll already foreshadow, comes from the word keha. Keha kuf hei hei is something sour. For example, chometz, vinegar, is called kuf hei hei in Aramaic. So it says, bavur ze asa Hashem li betzeti mitzrayim. Hashem, because of these mitzvot, God took us out of Egypt. And these mitzvot, you say that they're mine and they're not yours. You know what? They are mine and they are not yours. Ilu ayasham lo haya nigal. Even if you were there, God would not have taken you out of Egypt. Now, the questions here, they are just so many. In addition to what does it mean, you shall put vinegar on his teeth. Question number one, even before that, this is not a nice way to answer the Ben Rasha. You know, thank God that he comes to the Seder. He still is somehow connected to the family and tradition. You know, you're chasing him away by saying, you know what, even if you were in Egypt, you would not have been redeemed. That does not sound like a very nice or educational answer. Another question is, it's not true. If he were in Egypt, God would have taken him out of Egypt. God took everyone out of Egypt. So he would have taken him out of Egypt. So why are you telling him God would not have taken you out of Egypt? Another question is, what does it mean, af ata? You also put vinegar on his teeth. He did not put vinegar on your teeth. So what does it mean, and you, in return, also put vinegar on his teeth? He didn't put vinegar on my teeth. What's going on here? And the real basic question is, what does it mean to put vinegar on the teeth? So Rav Bakshi Doron explains that when he was young, about 90 years ago, growing up in Israel, the dentists did not use x-ray machines. How did they know if you had a cavity? They would actually put vinegar on the tooth that hurts, and if you jump, that's a sign that there's decay there. So this is what the dentists used to do before there were x-rays. Now, what is going on here? Rav Bakshi Doron explained, and some of the people will remember, the famous Ne'um HaShfanim, the rabbit speech of Rav Shach, where in, what year was this? I wrote it down before. I don't have it offhand. Somewhere around the 90s, where it was called the Targil HaMasriach. And Shas played a trick, and they pretended that they were going to bring down Yitzhak Shamir's Likud government and go with the Labor Party and form a government with Shimon Peres. And what happened was everyone was waiting whether Agudat Yisrael, the Ashkenazic Haredim, would they go with Shas to form a leftist government, or will they stay with the Likud in the right-wing government? The entire world wanted to know whether the peace process, which had begun in Madrid not too long before, Yitzhak Shamir went to Madrid, whether the peace process was going to continue, whether there was going to be peace in the Middle East. So America was interested, Russia was interested, all of the Israelis and Jews were interested. Is there going to be new elections to which Labor, a leftist government, is going to come to power? Or is Agudat Yisrael and Rav Shach going to stay with the Likud and with Yitzhak Shamir? They rented out all of the Yad Eliyahu Stadium, the largest stadium, indoor stadium in Israel at the time, in Tel Aviv. And the entire nation saw, broadcasted on live television, and all the politicians in America and in Russia were watching on live television, what is Rav Shach going to decide? And what he basically said, and that's why it's called the Speech of the Rabbits, he said, you left-wingers, you eat rabbits, you work on Yom Kippur, on the kibbutzim, they don't eat kosher, they eat rabbits again, and why should a Jewish state have a government that eats rabbits? In other words, he was saying, he's going with the Likud, he's staying with Yitzhak Shamir. Now, the following day, Rav Shach, Zichrono Livracha, had one son, Effie Shach. He learned in Yeshiva University, and he was a professor. And he called up his father, and he said, Rav Shach, you had the entire Jewish community, also in Israel and also abroad, listening to you. Why don't you make a Kiddush Hashem, say something that will show them the beauty of Torah, make them want to be Balei Tshuva. When did you ever have 1 million Jews listening to you live? Rav Shach said, you don't understand. Did you see the newspapers? So his son Effie said, yeah, I saw the newspapers. Rav Shach said, well, did you see Yossi Sarid? You remember Yossi Sarid? Jay Shapiro, I'm sure you remember Yossi Sarid. Yossi Sarid wrote a full-page article in the op-ed in Haaretz newspaper, under the title "Ani Lo Yehudi, Ma Ose Oti Li Yehudi," that was the title. What makes me a Jew? ! Because that's what Rav Shach said to the leftists. He said, "What makes you Jewish? You work on Shabbat. You eat rabbits. You don't keep kosher. You don't eat kosher for Pesach. What makes you Jewish?" And that's it. Rav Shach got the reaction that he wanted. Yossi Sarid jumped up and said, what makes me Jewish? I made Aliyah. I was an officer in the army. I dedicated my life to serving the Jewish people. What makes me Jewish? Rav Bakshi Doron said, that is what the dentists used to do. When they put something on your tooth, they put vinegar on your tooth to see your reaction, to see if you jump. If you don't jump, well, that's a sign that the tooth is totally dead. But if you jump and say, what makes me Jewish? Or in the dentist's office, aye, that hurt. That means that if you put in a filling or maybe a root canal, but you can save the tooth. And that is why we tell that, according to Rav Bakshi Doron, why we tell the evil son, why we say, even if you were there, you God would not have saved you. It's not true, but we want to see his reaction. And that is why that's not really a good educational reaction for the evil son. But we want to see his reaction to see whether his Yiddish neshama, whether his Jewish soul is still alive. And that answers the question, the age-old question, what does it mean to put a vinegar on his teeth? I wish you all a Chag Kasher v'sameach. I have to run. Avi, I'm going to come over to you for a second. I'll see you soon.
I really enjoyed that.